Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In his path-clearing new book, Parables of Coercion, Conversion and Knowledge at the End of Islamic Spain, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2015, Seth Kimmel, Assistant Professor of Latin American and Iberian Cultures at Columbia University, presents a fascinating account of how conversion from Islam to Christianity was imagined, debated, and contested in early modern Spain. Shifting the focus from the experiences of the converts to intellectual discussions and disputes on matters such as coercion and assimilation, Kimmel demonstrates that such discussions were intimately tied to not only questions of religious reform, but also to the demarcation of varied scholarly disciplines within Christianity. It is this nexus of knowledge, religious reform, and conversion that this book brilliantly explores and uncovers. Questioning binaries such as tolerance, intolerance, and religious secular, Kimmel highlights the complex material, intellectual, and political conditions and considerations that informed scholarly engagements with the questions and puzzles of religious conversion in early modern Spain. In our conversation, we talked about the major themes and arguments of the book and its striking relevance to discourses on religious tolerance in the present. Parables of Coercion is at once beautifully written and unusually multi-layered for a first book. It will also make an excellent choice for courses on Muslim-Christian relations, early modern religion, religious conversion, secularism, and on Islamic Spain. Here now is my conversation with Professor Seth Kimmel. Hello, Seth. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you? I'm doing well.
Very good, Seth. As I was saying before we went live, such a pleasure reading this book. As I said to you, the word multi-layered is really the one that comes to mind. There is such layers of analysis that go into this book and does not really read like a first book. So congratulations on such a wonderful book. Look forward to talking to you. And there is a tradition that we have on New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is always biographical. The question is, Seth, could you share with our listeners a bit, how did you become a scholar interested in Islam and, Spain and so on? And secondly, tell us a bit about how you came to write this particular book.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. First off, thanks for having me. Thanks for the compliment. I'm glad you found something useful and enjoyable in reading this book. I first became interested in religious studies, history of Islam, and Muslim societies, I'd say, as early as my undergraduate days. I studied comparative literature as an undergrad and a grad student, actually, but I actually minored in religious studies. So I've had a kind of longstanding interest in the history of religion. And when I decided to go to grad school in Comp Lit, I always knew that I'd be sort of Spain-focused, both because of my interests in early modern Spanish literature, and because I knew that it was when you study Comp Lit, you always have to have your foot in one of the national literature departments. And for me, it made sense to be in Spanish and Portuguese. But I had this kind of nagging feeling that I still wanted to do something with religion. And as I started to get into medieval and early modern Spanish literature a little more deeply, I started to realize that there really were lots of wonderful connections to the wider Mediterranean, to the Arab world. And it actually started, I was trying to write a paper on this text called Kalila Wadimna, which is it's kind of a mirror for princes text. It's an allegorical story about animal stories that are introduced into the European context via the Arab translations of originally Sanskrit texts. And as I was trying to write this paper, I just realized that I really needed to know Arabic in order to write the paper the way I wanted to. This is as a grad student. And my professors, in Comp Lit, we had a lot of flexibility to kind of shape our own intellectual trajectory. And everybody was really supportive of starting Arabic, even though it was a little late in the game for me. And as I started to do that, I realized that that many of the Hispanists who study Islam and who study Arabic literature, Arabic literary history, were using their Arabic knowledge and using that comparative context in order to transform their own fields. So it's just to say that for a very long time, Spanish studies, let's call it, and Arabic literary studies were totally separate. And even if you were studying Al-Andalus, if you were studying Iberian Peninsular texts written in Arabic, you very rarely did it in a Spanish department. And that started to change. I was reading, you know, people like Maria Rosamund Ocal, Américo Castro, and I started to realize that there was a kind of professional usefulness to opening up Iberian studies and opening up Spanish and Portuguese to a wider array of languages, including not just Arabic, but also other languages of the Iberian Peninsula, so Catalan, Basque, which are particularly important for other periods. So as I started to realize that, I became kind of frustrated with the nature of some of that scholarship. I realized that much of the scholarship was interested in sort of identifying the influence of this Arabic literary history or Islamic legal history or a kind of cultural history of Al-Andalus, examining the influence of these strands of Iberian culture on the Spanish and Latin context, on the one hand, or in the later period, in the Renaissance, after there were no longer any Jews or Muslims openly on the peninsula, trying to figure out in what ways did the experience of conversion shape Golden Age Spanish literature in the 16th and 17th century? And I kind of hit a wall. I became really frustrated with this kind of scholarship. And I tried to find a way to historicize the things that I was seeing in the modern scholarship, which is what led me to what became my first book. It started off as my dissertation. It led me to think historically about some of the modern scholarly and political debates that were happening in the American Academy and elsewhere as well, to a certain extent. And so in looking back and seeing how 16th century scholars used debates about the relationship between, for example, the Arabic literary history and Spanish literary history, or thought about the relationship of exchange and conflict between Muslim and Christian princes. So thinking about how in the Renaissance already different communities of scholars were weighing in on these debates as a way, in part, of shaping their own institutional home. So it was a kind of long and winding path. It kind of sounds nice and neat, but of course it was incredibly messy along the way.
Right.
But that's the story, really, of how I came to write this book and how I became interested in this comparative literary history of the Iberian Peninsula.
So let's begin with a broad question. The book is titled Parables of Coercion. Could you share with our listeners, and you really have dealt with a number of new archives which will not be familiar to many people. So could you begin by telling us, broadly speaking, what is the central goal, argument, and the intervention that this book tries to make?
Sure. So I, from the very beginning, I always had hoped that I'd be able to address a broad audience, a multidisciplinary audience of scholars who work on early modern Spain, but also scholars who might be interested in the history of religion from other fields, other time periods. And so I see the book working on at least two levels. One is addressing that broader audience. And that audience, I think, would be interested in this argument about the relationship between tolerance and intolerance, and more broadly about how religion, the boundaries of religion, actually get defined. And so on that point, we have the sense that the discourse of tolerance can often serve reactionary or exclusionary ends. I mean, that's maybe not a surprise, especially to people working on the modern period. Mm-hmm. But I think more rarely examined is the ways in which a discourse of intolerance can paradoxically have, you know, I don't use the word in the book, but maybe in this sort of general conversation, but think about it as progressive ends, which is to say ways of making spaces for diverse communities, for multiplicity of languages and points of view. So part of what my goal is to problematize that distinction between what counts as tolerance and what counts as intolerance, and to see how scholars can use those discourses to surprising ends. And so that's the kind of general argument. The more specific argument for Hispanists and for people working in early modern Spain is that these different communities of scholars, I talk about people who study language, philologists, as well as historians, canon lawyers, early modern economists, how each of these groups of scholars weighs in on debates about the Moriscos, debates about conversion from Islam to Christianity in the 16th century as a way of shaping their own fields. So in that sense, it's a disciplinary history. It's a history of the changing conventions and presuppositions of how scholars work in the 16th century.
So, actually, Seth, could you very briefly, you know, since NBIS link travels in multiple spaces, could you very briefly tell us who are the Moriscos for the benefit of our listeners?
Sure. Yeah, that would be a great place to start, actually. So, the Moriscos are it's a community of converts to Christianity from Islam that came into formation at the end of the 16th, beginning the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century. So Granada is conquered by Christian forces in late 1491. It's turned over in 1492, and for several decades afterwards, and in other parts of Spain, there are still Muslims living under Christian rule. And at a certain point in the early 16th century, all of those communities are forcibly converted to Christianity. So the resulting Christian community of those conversions is known as Moriscos. And so the Morisco period really runs from the turn of the century there until the early part of the 17th century, when this community of Christians is, again, forcibly not converted this time, but expelled from the peninsula. So those are the Moriscos. And in some ways, it parallels the story of the Jews and the forcible conversions of the Jews. That community becomes known as conversos, with the distinction that the Jewish community did, by and large, a more thorough job of integrating into old Christian society, whereas the Moriscos, for many decades, remained a kind of community apart. And so, of course, there were Jews that were expelled and that left in 1492, the famous expulsion decree. But over the previous 100 years, many Jews had become part of Spanish society, whereas the Moriscos, only a kind of upper crust elite, managed the transition well.
Mm-hmm. Now, much of your book, Seth, is occupied by this saga of trying to nurture a certain Christian orthodoxy among the Moriscos. And you also discuss in tremendous detail and very fascinating ways the disputes and the debates among the learned elite regarding the acceptability of coercion or the desirability of assimilation. And you argue that these debates shape the way, you know, categories like ritual and belief and conversion were imagined and came to be thought about. Could you explain that line of your argument of what were these learned disputes about and how did they shape the ways in which these categories were imagined?
Sure. So the disputes shift over the course of the Morisco period. So at the moments of conversion and the several decades afterwards, there's this great anxiety about whether coercion had actually happened. So when the last Muslims of Granada are rounded up and brought to the central plaza, and there's a kind of flexible ceremony where holy water is sprinkled, some prayers are said, the question is, do they emerge as Christians? And from 10, 20 years later, that's a difficult canon law problem for Christian scholars, because on the one hand, coercion is impermissible under canon law. And on the other hand, these conversions already happened. And to undo the conversions, to try and, through some sort of legalese, to undo them, would risk the possibility of a second moment of conversion, which just would muddle the water even further. So in the early decades of the 16th century, the debate is really about a first moment of conversion and whether it's effective or not, right, as a ritual. As the century unfolds and there's this decision that that moment was indeed effective, theoretically, but pragmatically on the ground, there's all sorts of ways in which the Morisco community remains unassimilated and to a certain extent still heterodox. So there's a series of councils and negotiations, each time, at least on paper, forcing this Morisco community to stop using Arabic, to stop dressing in this particular way, to stop participating in cultural practices that were associated with the Muslim community, but until that moment of regulation really didn't have any religious significance, something like going to the bathhouse or eating certain foods. So over the course of trying to regulate the cultural practices of these Moriscos, cultural and linguistic practices, you have what I see as a kind of sacralization of culture. So at stake there in trying to regulate this community is an expansion of what counts as religious practice, at least for the purposes of the Morisco community. Now, this expansion of religious practice served canon lawyers, served theologians quite well, because it meant that they had a new claim on how questions about imperial and religious identity both played out in the public sphere. So that's the focus of the first, let's say, half of the book. And over the course of the second half, I turn more towards questions about, specifically about language and history. So as it became clear that the projects of linguistic and cultural assimilation were actually not working, then there became anxiety about, well, what's the next step? How do we write the history of this period, which looks like a failure? It's a failed process of assimilation. And so that failure in the end led to the proponents of expulsion winning over the crown, and the proponents of a more, let's call it, Irenic approach, people who wanted through various ways, both peaceful and actually coercive, to integrate this community, they lost the battle, and the Moriscos were finally expelled in the 17th century. So at that moment, there's this kind of retrospective look to try and figure out what went wrong, to try and figure out what's the effect, what's the possible effect and actual effect of expelling this large community. And so at each moment in this narrative arc of the Morisco period, different communities of intellectuals, first canon lawyers, then philologists and other kinds of textual scholars, and finally historians, weigh in on this issue. And in the course of so doing, they seek to make a claim for their own fields on these debates.
Now, there is a very interesting category that you use and mobilize, which you call global fictions of conversion. Could you explain a bit what do you mean by global fictions of conversion?
Sure. So these scholars who were concerned with the Moriscos had, by this point, a kind of global canon, right? They had stories of miraculous conversions from the New World. This is after the period when Spanish explorers and conquerors are expanding throughout the Americas, and Portuguese explorers are passing into South Asia and Asia. And so there's this sense back home that some of the stories of conversion abroad might be helpful models for seeking the conversion and assimilation of this Morisco community back home. And I talk about global fictions of conversion because there is an awareness, especially among critical historians of the 16th century, that some of these stories are tall tales, right? They're self-serving stories of evangelical success. And a peninsular audience should be aware of that aspect of storytelling and be critical, right? To think about the realities on the ground in the peninsular context, and not to be taken in by the story of success and easy conversion abroad, and to address the difficulties with clear eyes.
Now, another conceptual thread that really runs throughout this book is this epistemological dilemma that you talk about, which is that on the one hand, there is this move to make compulsory participation in the life of the church, and this compulsion was meant to eliminate any kind of heterodoxy, but you show that this actually had the effect of indecipherability in terms of deciphering the distinction between orthodoxy and heresy, and which eventually led to the expulsion of such people from the church. So could you explain a bit what this dilemma is about and how it was negotiated and tackled?
Sure. So critical to this story of decide how to decide who is a Christian, who's not a Christian, is coming to some sort of agreement, some sort of consensus about what counts as Christianity and how do you measure a Christian subjectivity. And the groups of scholars that most interest me are those counter-Reformation theologians and linguists and cultural historians who recognize how difficult it is to measure someone's belief. So the holy office of the Inquisition, right, people who are trained to get people to convey their beliefs, even they realized that oftentimes it was simply impossible to get past those layers of language and expression and translation in order to understand what somebody actually believes. Others thought that even the individual was unsure what that person's beliefs was. So given that epistemological double bind, the scholars that interest me were the ones who said, you know what, let's not try and unearth what people believe, at least for the purposes of measuring what counts as Orthodox Christianity, and let's instead observe what people are actually doing, right? So that's part of the story that I mentioned earlier, the sacralization of culture. If you want to know that someone's a Christian, or at least subscribe to the fiction that what people do represents their Christianity, then you need to have a kind of expanded sense of ritual action. So not only attendance at church, not only participation in mass, not only following certain catechism classes, but also speaking in a certain way, dressing in a certain way, etc. And so there is a certain dissimulation that's at stake here. And this is a story, in some cases, of a kind of charitable dissimulation. So Christian scholars, some of whom I focus on at great length in my book, like Pedro de Valencia, for example, or Ignacio Las Casas, are willing to turn a blind eye in the short term to Morisco dissimulation, which is to say, Moriscos who are pretending to be Christian but are continuing to practice and believe in secret their previous Islam. So there are some Christian scholars who are willing to turn a blind eye to that dissimulation in the short term with the hope that in the long term, participation in Christian life, participation in Christian ritual will ultimately produce the orthodoxy that they have failed to instill from the get-go. And so that's a kind of conflict between two forms of dissimulation. And of course, the inquisitors, the more kind of conservative scholars who are seeking to root out Morisco heterodoxy, have their own strategies for dissimulation, right? They're trying to catch the heretics in their lies. So in some ways, one way to think about the stories I'm telling in the book is as a conflict and balance among these competing models of dissimulation. And one effect of this multiplicity of dissimulations is that it becomes extremely difficult to ultimately decide what rituals and words and actions actually mean. So you mentioned indecipherability. That's what I mean, that these rituals of the Moriscos, their participation in church ritual, their cultural habits become, in a certain way, illegible. And the challenge for Christian scholars is to figure out a way to render that illegibility in some ways interpretable, understandable.
Now, in chapter 4 of your book, The Heterodoxy, or Translating Heterodoxy, you talk about a really fascinating episode of a moment when these Arabic texts were discovered in Granada that came to be known as the Lead Books. Am I pronouncing that? Is it Lead Books, right?
Lead Books, yeah.
Lead Books, yeah. So could you tell us a bit about what are the lead books? And you show here to further this thread of sanctifying or sacralizing culture. Here you talk about sacralizing a certain body of texts, and you show ways in which the way in which these texts were translated, edited, and interpreted, there was a way in which they were turned into scripture, what you call the invention of scripture. So tell us a bit about what are these lead books. Tell us an account of how they were discovered, and then how they were sanctified and turned into scripture through this process of translation, edition, editing, and interpretation.
Sure. So, I mean, so these lead books are really fascinating documents, and there's been a lot of specialized scholarship on them over, especially over the last 20 or 30 years. They are a series of circular lead tablets that have Arabic etching on them that were discovered in the hills outside of Granada over the course of the 1590s. And once translators and scholars got their hands on them and were able to read them, it became clear that the books purported to be the narrative of an ancient early Christian saint. And so they pretended to be gospel texts, basically. And of course, the Granadan local community was very happy to discover these ancient Christian texts because for many, many centuries, it had been a Muslim city. And so there was great local excitement about the possibility of Granada becoming a kind of pilgrimage site and being great pride, right, in this early Christian local history. But it soon became clear, and the learned Arabists and classicists of the period weighed in on these texts, and it became clear that they were forgeries for a variety of reasons. There were inconsistencies in the Arabic. There were historical inconsistencies, and by and large, the learned community decided that they were forgeries. Now, they were just discovered alongside some relics, which is as you'll see in a second, is important to the story. So the learned community more or less decided they were forgeries, and at the same time, popular Granadan piety was at a high. People were really excited. They started pilgrimage sites. There's the foundation of an abbey. A whole kind of institutional structure that grows out of this popular piety around the discovery of the lead books. And so from that popular piety, there grew a kind of secondary scholarly interest. And there was a major effort to, as you pointed out earlier, to sacralize these texts, to make them comprehensible as Christian scripture. So what do you need to do that? First of all, you need to make them into either Latin or Spanish. You need to translate the text from Arabic, which is no easy undertaking given the difficult, you know, the Arabic writing is already unique. It's etched, so that it's angular. It looks very strange, even to somebody who is knowledgeable in Arabic. You need to make them books, right? You need to turn these texts into something that could fit inside a kind of printed Bible so that it would make sense as part of the Christian canon. And so that process ultimately fails. The Pope finally declared, well, nearly 100 years later, the discoveries to be forgeries. And it's likely, scholars now agree, that they were probably forged by some of their early Morisco translators, in fact. The Morisco forgers and translators were trying to imagine through these texts a kind of harmonious, a kind of Mediterranean religious harmony. They emphasized a Christianity that was more open to Islamic iconography, and that the Moriscos would have found more palatable. So they emphasized figures such as Mary, for example, that are found in both traditions. There's some of the Arabic language echoes some Quranic language. So there's this real effort to imagine a Morisco-friendly Christianity. And ultimately, the institutional structure of Rome wasn't convinced and declared the texts forgeries. However, given the laws of authentication of texts and relics in the aftermath of the Council of Trent, it was the local church, it was the Granadan church that had authority to decide on the authenticity of the relics. So the upshot of this long process of learned debate over the nature of these texts and the relics is that the texts are declared forgeries, but the relics are declared authentic. And to this day, there's something called the Abbey of Sacromonte, which is where the lead books, it's on the hillside behind the Alhambra where the lead books were discovered. And there's still pious pilgrimages and celebrations at this abbey celebrating these relics, even though the texts themselves have been declared inauthentic. So what really interests me in this whole story is that there's a kind of openness and an awareness among scholars that are both defending and attacking the texts and the relics that holiness is produced conventionally, institutionally. There's a series of processes that occur in order to render a text canonical. And you see the defenders of the text sometimes cynically marshaling the power at their disposal to manage that process. And you see critics of the text trying to marshal their kind of humanistic, different kind of cynicism to say, no, these are forgeries and we shouldn't be taken in by them. And so to see that process at work is to get a sense of how holiness is conventionally produced. And part of what was so surprising for me, and I think it's surprising for scholars who are less familiar with Spain, and even scholars who spend their lives studying Spain, is the candidness, right? The comfort that these even theologians have with the conventionality and the institutional nature of these processes for producing holiness and orthodoxy.
Now, in what ways, to talk about another theme that you discuss in your book, and you mentioned earlier about the relationship between narratives of Morisco integration or lack thereof and how it impacted language and history, right, and history writing. So in relation to that, in what ways, when early modern authors wrestled with and meditated on the failure of Morisco integration, how did that generate the conditions to think more carefully and interrogate the very craft of history writing and different aspects of historical writing? Could you tell us a bit about that aspect of your discussion?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that I study in the latter chapters of the book. And it gets at this problem of this anxiety over how to write the story of a failure. The court historians and chroniclers of the period were accustomed to adding each year to a kind of stable corpus of great feats of the monarchy, adding each year the new feats, right? The new great acts of the soldiers and monarchs. And it's during this period that you start to see more local histories. So you have historians based far away from court and writing a more kind of critical history. So they're drawing on classical models. And Tacitus, for example, was a famous model for critical historians of the early modern period. But even so, you see someone like the humanist and historian Diego Hurtado de Mendoza, who's based in Granada, you see him struggle to find the language that's still recognizable as history to his audiences, but that is not celebratory, that is a more critical version of, and his focus is this war from the 1560s and 1570s in Granada, which was a kind of final moment of uprising by the Morisco community, who was increasingly angry about these regulations that I've been talking about, regulations on their language and dress, etc. And so Hurtado Mendoza and other historians of the moment, some of them participated in the war and saw the violence, struggled to find a way to tell that story. And to do that, they needed to test what counted as history writing in the moment. They needed to find a way to not have the narrative run towards a kind of happy conclusion, even though the Morisco rebellion was put down, given the terrible effects on the local economy, the great suffering by the Morisco community and by Christian soldiers. And so it's looking back not only on that that particular conflict from the 1560s and 1570s, but the entire history of the Morisco period that preceded it and that led to that moment of conflict, and trying to find a way to tell that story.
Seth, as a final substantive question, let us talk a bit about the conceptual and political stakes of this project in relation to the present and how we think about early modern Spain and Christian-Muslim relations and so on. And as you point out, you know, in the beginning of your book also, that oftentimes you're arrested in these very facile binaries of tolerance, intolerance, inclusion, exclusion, and so on. And one of the things that I see your book doing is by giving us such a detailed picture of the early modern context, you've really punctured the coherence of these kinds of binaries. But let me have you talk a bit about how you see as the political and conceptual intervention that you see this project making in terms of how we imagine this past in relation to Christian-Muslim relations and misconceptions about the Inquisition and discourses of tolerance, intolerance, and so on. So an open-ended question.
Yeah, it's a great and challenging question. Well, you know, you hear bandied about in the news these days. Oftentimes, you'll hear talk of fundamentalism. You'll hear talk of people who are committed to religion for whatever reasons, in whatever ways, as being medieval in a certain way, for example. And that's it's a way of criticizing. It's a way of making a modern political criticism by drawing on some kind of historical stereotype. And part of what's so interesting about Spain in relationship to this story of the Middle Ages is that in Spain, the usual historical account is inverted. So that you have in the Middle Ages, under when the peninsula was mostly under Islamic rule, you have this story about great flourishing, right? Great cultural flourishing, maybe not as intense religious conflict or conflict that's political, but maybe not necessarily explicitly religious all the time. And over the last, 50 years, say, scholars have developed a much more nuanced view of that Iberian Middle Ages. To say that this story of convivencia, as it's called, this getting along, was actually a quite violent one. So my story is really the opposite in the early modern period, is that this moment that's famous in Spain as a kind of inquisitorial moment when the rest of Europe is heading fast towards the Enlightenment, let's say, that's a kind of simple but common story, that even Inquisition can be employed to surprisingly progressive uses, surprising tools for opening up modes of scholarship, for rethinking the boundaries between different communities. Mm-hmm. So in that way, just as a kind of general point, Spain is unusual. And it's Spain's both unusualness and also the fact that the story of Golden Age Spain, the story of a Golden Age in the Middle Ages of Spain, and the story of Inquisition is well known even to a kind of general reader. So by turning some of those assumptions on their head, I hope that people will see that when we use language like fundamentalism, I mean, there's maybe nothing more fundamentalist than the Spanish Inquisition, that we might seek also to historicize contemporary geopolitical debates where the question of religious actors is equally at stake, to see that there's always local motivations. There's local political and institutional histories that help to shape the way people act, why people act the way they do. And that sometimes our broad portraits are dangerous because they help us to stereotype rather than to understand.
So as we are approaching the end of our time, Seth, could you share with us a bit what's the next project? What are you working on these days?
Yeah, so it's fun and also overwhelming to start something new. But I'm hoping to continue my interest in archives and early printed books, material culture, and also the history of the disciplines, this transformation of scholarship and knowledge in the early modern period, by thinking a little bit about some other disciplines that didn't play such a big role in this book, specifically cartography, so map making and bibliography or collection, And there are a couple of interesting episodes in the early modern Western Mediterranean, let's say, where well-known cartographers and collectors are doing both jobs simultaneously. And I have the sense, yet to be proven, but I do have the sense that these individuals' bibliographic practices, the way that they organize their knowledge, and their cartographic practices, the way they imagine both local and global space, transform each other, shape each other. So a couple of episodes. One will be hopefully in Seville. There's the illegitimate second son of Christopher Columbus, Hernando Colon, had his big collection there. I think that the story of the Escorial, the major royal library and monastery founded in the late 16th century, will be part of the story. And then there's a famous library of the Sultan of the Saudi Sultan Moulay Zidane, which was lost at sea and ended up in the Escorial. So there too, there's a story of bibliographic and, let's say, cartographic intrigue. So I think that that's where I'm headed for next project, but you'll have to check back. Hopefully it won't take 10 years.
Parables of Coercion, Conversion and Knowledge at the End of Islamic Spain, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2015. Thank you so much, Seth, for your time, for this wonderfully rich book, and for this intellectual feast, both in terms of your writing and also now your very articulate responses to some of these questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. So this was my conversation with Professor Seth Kimmel about his book, Parables of Coercion. Thank you so much for listening, and please also join us next time for another fresh episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Thank you, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.